everyone. Welcome to On the Market. Today, we're going to be running through some of the most important newsworthy stories impacting the world of real estate investing. We're going to be talking about the recent Federal Reserve meeting and some nuggets of information that they've been sprinkling out there for us to interpret. We'll have an update on the antitrust lawsuits impacting major brokerages and the National Association of Realtors. And we'll talk about an increase in housing market supply. To help me with this, we have James, Henry, and Kathy as usual. So let's get into it. All right, our first headline today is there are five main takeaways from the Federal Reserve meeting. You're probably aware of this, but the Federal Reserve Board meets every couple of weeks. And afterward, investors, people who invest in the stock market, and more recently, people who invest in real estate, all try and figure out what the heck the Fed is going to do based on their press conferences and any information they give out. So we're going to take our turn at that and try and speculate about what the Fed means. So, Kathy, let's start with you. What did the Fed say and didn't say, and what do you take from all of it?
Well, the Fed did not raise rates, so that was expected. And they did say that they probably will cut rates 2 to 3 times this year, as they said before, so that's still on track, but probably towards the end of the year. And that, you know, this is not too surprising because the job market has been still so strong. What was interesting for all of those people out there who've really been hoping for a recession and predicting one for, 10 years or so, they are now forecasting economic growth from, it's been increased, the forecast from 1.4 to 2.1%. So in spite of the fact that the economy is still really strong, the good news for the markets and for real estate and for anyone hoping that rates will come down is that they are saying that they will still plan to cut rates, even though the economy is looking strong and we're not headed into a recession at this time.
That's really important to note that the Fed is projecting economic growth this year, and 2.1% is a little bit lower than average. So it's not like they're projecting some economic boom right now, but it is important to note that the people who are watching this and who are making monetary policy decisions do think that the economy is going to keep growing. So, Henry, let me just ask you, quick and dirty, do you pay attention to each and every one of these meetings?
I pay attention to the bullet points as it comes out. For me, it's more about trying to understand how this might impact my real estate portfolio in the long term because I'm accumulating right now because I can get such great deals. And what I want to be able to do with that portfolio is if and when rates start to come down and prices potentially, hopefully rise with that, with those rates coming down, then I'll be able to better evaluate my portfolio, sell off some properties, take advantage of some forced appreciation, and then put that forced appreciation to work.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I'm curious if you think, though, that the Fed has credibility. I don't know the right way to say it. Like, I know a lot of people have a lot of like conspiracy theories about the Fed. Like, I don't really believe in a lot of those things. I just think they've been wrong a lot over the last couple of years. So I'm just wondering, like, do you take it everything, you know, at their word, or are you sort of just try and understand generally what they're thinking and get the gist of their intention, even if they don't actually follow through on everything they say?
I don't take any news source at its word in general.
Except this podcast, of course.
Except this one, right?
Yeah, right.
And so I'm not taking it at its word, and kind of the I guess what you call the hedge for my strategy is I'm only buying good deals that are going to have a financial benefit to me right now in this economy. And so even if the market doesn't do what the Fed says it's going to do, I still bought really good deals that benefit me in the current environment. And then I'm taking what could come if things go the way the Fed says it's going to go. I'll take that as icing on the cake or a big bonus.
How do you see this, James? Are you going to be altering your approach at all based on recent announcements, or is this something you just take note of and sort of file it away as one data point that's impacting your strategy?
I tend to pay attention when they're talking. I try not to overthink it right now, though, because one issue I was having is I would actually listen to all the minutes and read through them all, and then I'd start overthinking every little point that they would make. And, you know, one of the key takeaways was their economic growth for the year went from 1.4 to 2.1. And like you said, Dave, 2.1 is a little bit below average, but it's showing that there's indicators that the economy is doing better and better. And, you know, being a 2008 investor, I had a lot of doom and gloom coming in the last 2 years because I had that whiplash of going, okay, if something suddenly changes, it can have mass impact across your portfolio and how you invest. And so I've been very cautious. But as we see this progress, we are seeing more and more of a soft landing, which I did not expect. When I saw rates shoot up, I thought we were going to see a lot more issues across the board, and we're not really seeing it as much. I think the consumers are feeling it based on inflation and just cost of goods now and cost of services are just higher and they're going to remain higher. But we're starting to get into this normal feeling of this is just the way our economy is going to go. And as an investor, if I feel like there's normality in the market, it means that we have actually shrunk down our expectations for deal flow too. So we went from having a lot wider margins to now we're bringing it back to normal because this is more of a normal market for us. Things are buying, we can renovate, we can rent them, we can sell them. And because there's normality in it, we can kind of reduce our expected returns. And I think that is important to do as an investor because as the market or the economy is kind of staying stable, there's a lot more investors in the market. And if you don't adjust your expected returns, you're not going to be able to get in the game. And so for us, it's about really listening to this. What adjustments do we need to do on our expected returns? And then how can we keep buying? Because if you don't stay in the market, you're going to be further down the road in 12 months. And so it's just based on these meetings, we're just adjusting our risk tolerance. And I think it's important for everybody to listen to, you know, rates could be going down, inflation is going to slow down, they're projecting a higher GDP. Those are good things, even though we're not getting that doom and gloom crash where we thought we were going to have the buying opportunity of all time.
Nice. Thank you for sharing that. I think that makes a lot of sense, just adjusting your risk tolerance. It's not like you're changing operations or everything that you're doing, but you're just trying to understand what risks, what deals are worth it in this current climate. I do want to give my periodic public service announcement here that I always give about the Fed and mortgage rates, which is that the Fed does not control mortgage rates. I just want to reiterate that. And what I sort of took away from this is that they are doing what they said that they were going to do at the previous meeting. And to me, that's what's important because the market, the bond market, which is what actually does control mortgage rates, is forward looking. And they basically, they price in what the Fed says that they're going to do. So as long as the Fed stays on this track of three cuts this year, we're probably not going to see a lot of movement in bond yields and therefore in mortgage rates. So I know people are still expecting rates to come down. I do think they're going to come down a bit throughout the course of this year. But don't expect if the Fed says at the next meeting, hey, we're cutting by 25 basis points and we're still on track for three this year, to see huge movement because everyone's already expecting that. And what happens and what creates movement is differentiation from what the Fed has previously said that they're going to do. So just keep that in mind as you pay attention to these announcements. We've hit our first headline now about the Fed meeting, but we do have several more headlines coming up, including an update on the antitrust lawsuits that NAR and many brokerages are facing. We'll get to that right after the break.
Interest rates are sky high in 2023, and buying a rental property means you could get stuck with an 8, 9, or 10% mortgage rate. But what about a 2.99% rate with Rent to Retirement? Rent to Retirement has 2.99% seller financing available on turnkey properties. You heard that right. That's a seller-financed 2.99% interest rate with an average cash flow of over $900 per month. Plus, they've got options where you can put as little as 5% down with no PMI. As the nation's leading turnkey investment company, Rent to Retirement helps investors build headache-free, high cash flow rental portfolios. And since their properties are fully turnkey, newly built or renovated, leased and managed, anyone can invest, even those who aren't into landlording. So what are you waiting for? This 2.99% rate deal won't last long. To learn more, visit renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com or text REI to 33777. Again, text REI to 33777.
Buy low, sell high. Very easy to say, but not always so easy to do. For example, high interest rates are hurting the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices in a lot of markets are falling, even for many of the best assets. So it's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/pockets. Fundrise.com/pockets. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
You're trying to close on your next rental, so why is your insurance company dragging its feet? With long lead times and never-ending paper forms, it's no wonder it takes forever to finally get a policy. Modern investors deserve better. They deserve Steadily.com. At Steadily.com, you'll get fast, affordable landlord insurance available online 24/7 in just a few clicks. You can even get next-day coverage, which takes just minutes, by the way, to obtain. And you can do it all from your phone. Steadily was founded by landlords who created insurance products tailored to the unique needs of this industry. It's their sole focus, and that's why landlords nationwide consistently rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars. So whether you've got a single family, short-term, or multifamily portfolio, Steadily.com can secure the best coverage at the best price to protect your properties. Discover how Steadily can save you both time and money on your rental property insurance. Visit Steadily.com for a commitment-free quote tailored to your needs today.
Welcome back to On the Market. So we're going to jump over to the big antitrust lawsuits that have been rocking the real estate world, really some of the biggest and most important real estate news in the last several years. And if you haven't heard already, we did release an episode talking all about sort of the facts and basically just getting everyone up to speed on what happened in the main settlement, which was with the National Association of Realtors. But the headline that we're going to be talking about today is that real estate brokerage Compass, this is a big brokerage throughout the country, they have agreed to also settle antitrust claims to the tune of $57.5 million. So James, as a real estate agent, I'm curious to get your opinion about this. Do you think this is sort of winding down the number of lawsuits that we're going to see, or is this just kind of the beginning?
You know, right now, I think all the big brokerages are kind of just looking to settle it and get it off their plate. I think we could see some more coming through. But, you know, every time there's a settlement, it's like there's less. I don't know. For my opinion, it was like that first initial one with Keller Williams, NAR. And now it's like, oh, everyone else is just starting to come to the table with it. I was kind of curious about some of these publicly traded brokerages that were backed by VCs and what that's going to do to their stock and their company all the way around. Because a lot of these companies, they gave out equity shares and profit share as the way to recruit brokers. So I feel like this could have some impact in some of these big brokerages that could go away eventually, just because the upside for brokers aren't there. I don't think this is the end of it. I'm not really worried about the lawsuits getting paid right now. I'm more worried about what is this going to do over the next 24 months to the brokers' fees, services, and how brokers work in today's market and how they're going to be working with buyers and sellers and how they're going to be compensated and what that's going to do to the real estate market as far as services that you need to provide. And so, you know, for us as a broker, we're trying to forecast that out and going, oh, how do we add extra services? How do we take care of our consumers better so we can keep our commissions up? Because as a pipeline business, I forecast my commissions out 12, 24 months. And if those could be reduced in one way, shape, or form, we have to figure out, how to cover that with cash flow, or how do we make adjustments to where we can still get paid our normal commissions that we were used to getting paid by the services and additional services that we're offering?
How are the different agents in your brokerage reacting to this, James? As an experienced, you know, head of the brokerage, I know you have different high-level concerns here about your whole business, but just for individual agents who are, you know, looking at a very different compensation model and perhaps big changes to their livelihood, what would you say the sentiment is?
You know, I think at our office, in the space that we hang out in, we're not too concerned because, like, we're a specialty brokerage shop. We're boutique. We offer a lot of additional services that many brokers don't. And, that keeps us apart, and we feel like our commissions are going to be protected all the way around. And the reason being is because, you know, if you hire a design builder, they're going to charge you more than a spec builder. If you hire a luxury travel broker, they're going to charge you more than the basic, right? Like Expedia, that's a cheap way to do it. And so we're not overly worried about it right now. And the brokers I'm talking to, it's funny, no one's really, I think they're just assuming that they're going to still get paid the same, and they're not really freaking out too much. But what I am hearing now is from investors, I get a lot of phone calls going, hey, what are we going to be doing in the future? Because they're looking at ways, how can they increase their net profit? How can they increase their margins? And they're now looking at, do we start looking at reducing commissions and having the buyers take care of that to increase their net? And so I'm getting more phone calls from investors and discussions from investors than I am brokers right now.
That's super interesting. I've heard similar things. People are wondering, like, should I buy deals now? Because in the future, real estate, you know, I might have to pay for a broker's agent. And right now, in the next 3 or 4 months before this law goes into effect, might be a good time to buy. Are you, Henry, are you noticing any of that pickup in activity or change in investor behavior?
No, I really haven't seen much change in investor behavior, nor change in the with the real estate agents that I work closely with. Now, I happen to work very closely with an agent whose brokerage is exceptional. And I don't believe that exceptional performing real estate brokerages are going to be as impacted as other people. If their focus is on customer service at a high level, I think those people are going to be able to survive in this new climate. I think all this is there's just a lot of uncertainty about how those agents are going to get paid. It's not that they're not going to get paid. We just don't know what that all looks like yet. It's not standardized. It's still brand new. It's probably going to be the Wild West for a little while until people figure out kind of what the consumer is comfortable with paying and what type of service that rate would then garner from that service provider. But I think once there's some precedent set, I think all this will calm down and it'll start to go back to business as usual. But right now, people freak out when there's things that are unknown, and there's just a lot of this that's going to be unknown. But it's also going to create a lot of opportunity. There's going to be opportunity for the brokerages who are super creative about the services that they provide and what fees they provide it for, maybe tiered levels of services for different costs. But whoever's willing and ready and prepared to be creative in how they service that consumer is probably going to be the first person to find their way into making a decent amount of money at servicing the customer who still really does need agent representation. Some of those people absolutely need agent representation. Some don't. But the ones that do, if you can find the way to service them in a way that doesn't put you out of business, I think that company stands to make a lot of money. It also offers some creativity. What if things like me, when I go and list a house on the market as a flipper, what if I put in the comments that, you know, if you want to make a bid on this house, I'll pay for your buying agent. I'll give you the credit for that, right? You know, there's all kinds of opportunities for being creative.
Huh, I like that idea. I hadn't heard something like that, thinking about how you can, as an investor, maybe incentivize people to look at your properties. It's a good idea. Kathy, you obviously work with a very large network of real estate service professionals across the country. What are you hearing from them?
Well, and we own a brokerage too, so we are right in the thick of it. And like James said, I love how he said it, we're a specialty brokerage. And we've never really considered ourselves real estate agents. That's why you probably didn't even know we were a brokerage, because we specialize in investor properties and helping investors find properties nationwide that cash flow. So that, again, is a specialty, and very rarely does anyone even bring up commission, because they want the deal, right? They just want a good deal and they want to buy it through the network. Oftentimes we're negotiating with builders who don't negotiate generally. It is very low anyway. The commission that they offer to brokers is just not very high anyway. So there's usually not very much room there to negotiate. So again, depending on what you do, it will affect you or it won't. I can tell you with all certainty that I have absolutely no idea how it's going to fall out in the future. And I think that's where the world's at. But anyone, what concerns me, and I said this last time we talked about this, what concerns me is that buyers won't get representation because they won't want to pay for it. And they don't maybe realize how much they need it. Anyone who's worked with a bad real estate agent will complain all day long and say that they don't do anything. And that is true. There are some that really don't do anything. So never get an agent who isn't familiar with your area or who doesn't have a long list of happy clients. You know, don't just hire your friend who's starting out. Get someone who's really good. And anyone who's worked with a really good real estate agent will pay them happily because they are worth it. They are worth it. So it will, you know, people have said the agents who don't do much will probably not get the business. A lot of agents will be working really hard to be the listing broker, right? Because then at least they could set their own commission. But yeah, nobody really knows. But again, my biggest concern for buyers is that they think they don't need one. And I can tell you, I'm a licensed agent. My husband's a broker and I still hire an agent in areas that I'm new to, that I don't know the rules or the laws or the issues, say in Texas, where you've really got to be more aware of foundation issues than say Florida, where you really need to be aware of flood zones and so forth. So having just make sure you're well represented as a buyer.
You know, Kathy, I agree with you. I think there are going to be some people who probably need representation who won't get it. But to me, that just sounds like a marketing issue for the companies that are offering that service. Like I equate it similarly to property management companies, right? Like it's their job to market to investors like me to tell me why I need a professional property manager and I shouldn't go out there and manage my properties on my own, right? It's up to them to have good business marketing plans. And I think it really just all ties back into, I think what we've all said is that if you're a good operator, you're going to be just fine.
Well, I totally agree with you, Henry, and what Kathy and James said earlier, that people who do specialize and provide tremendous amount of value, that you are likely to be okay. I just believe in that, like across the economy, if you just pursue giving value to people, that the profits come from that. But also recognize for real estate agents and anyone who works with them or family members that this is a really uncertain time. And even though we all expect the dust to settle and for the industry to find, you know, a new footing, that it is a difficult time. And so we are going to continue to provide opinions and updates on this topic as frequently as it makes sense. So make sure to stay tuned for that. Let's move on to our third headline today, which comes from Redfin. They say that supply, real estate supply, climbs 5%, the biggest increase in nearly a year. This is music to my ears. Henry, are you noticing this? Are you excited about it? Are you jumping for joy? What do you think?
Yes, I am noticing it. There are more new homes coming on the market. And I think that has a lot to do with kind of what the rest of this article is signaling, is that people are just becoming more comfortable with the economy and with the real estate market and with where interest rates are. And that is picking up in terms of picking up volume in terms of buyers and sellers. And to me, it's just signaling a healthy market. We are seeing an increase. And even though we're seeing an increase, we're still seeing the good product, air quotes here for those of you who are listening and not watching, we're seeing the good product go quickly. I just listed a house. I had probably 15 showings in 48 hours, and I had 2 full price offers within that time frame, even though we had an increase in inventory this month compared to last month. And that just shows that the good product is going fast. The not so good product, you can still see a ton of it on the market. I was looking at a property the other day that had been on the market for over a year. And it's what you want, right? You want good product to be desirable and people to be out there bidding on it. And you want the less desirable product to sit there. And that less desirable product creates opportunities for people like James and I.
Well, that is good news. James, are you seeing the same thing?
You know, I'm not seeing it in our market. I mean, we're seeing stuff hit, but, you know, the key kind of stats I took away from this was pending sales were down 4.4. Inventory was up. And then pricing was up around 5% over year over year as far as listed prices. We're seeing some things come to market, but our market has gotten tighter and tighter and tighter. And there is not a whole lot to buy. And I can tell you there's 10x more buyers in the market right now on the West Coast, at least where I'm feeling it. And it's becoming very, very competitive. And I think that might have to do with, like, historically, typically, you know, when markets go through cycles, the more expensive ones typically adjust first, and then it kind of rolls through, right? And what we're seeing is, I think some of the Midwest and the South is slowing down a little bit from what I hear. Like, there's more inventories, taking a little bit more time to transact, but not much longer. And we're seeing the West Coast, in my opinion, heat up again, especially in Seattle. I know down in Newport, it's hot. Things are moving, and they're moving for higher pricing. And so, you know, what we could see is the West Coast takes a jump ahead. And then, you know, as the maybe the South, the North, you know, some of these markets that are cooling down a little bit, it might stall and level out, but they could also pop right back up following the West Coast. I'm not seeing a ton more inventory. I'm seeing less inventory. I just bought a house literally 30 minutes before we got on this podcast, and I had to move quick. I did a virtual walkthrough. I said, I'll take it right now. There were 16 people lined up right behind me to come in.
Wow.
And so basically sight unseen, and those are the buying conditions that we're in right now. And that's because there isn't a whole lot of inventory, at least in the Seattle market. It's getting absorbed. One thing that I am seeing inventory kind of increase a little bit is we have a lot of new construction product hitting market all at the same time. And builders do that for timing. They're trying to hit that spring market because spring market always produces more inventory. So it's nothing major to where I think it's a big shift. I think it's just kind of a seasonal market change. And you know, it's funny, they're like, oh, inventory's up. Well, it's supposed to be up springtime. That's when people move. And so, but we are seeing more new construction, but it is being absorbed a lot quicker than it was 5 months ago.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because if you guys didn't listen to a recent episode, James and Henry are betting on who can generate a better profit for a flip. And I bet on James as my horse. And so I like hearing these conditions because it is ripe for property appreciation, but obviously not great for investors or homebuyers who are trying or hoping for greater inventory. Kathy, do you see this as just a blip? Or do you agree that sort of this is the start of a new trend and perhaps even somewhere down the road, a healthier housing market, even though it's not happening in Seattle, that maybe this trend might, you know, pick up at least on a national basis?
Well, we know that we need more inventory. So it's just funny with the headlines try to make it sound scary and bad, but it's really actually good news. We need more inventory. When they say that sales have climbed, you know, 5% or soared might be some of the headlines. 5% is, the number of U.S. homes for sale has gone up 5%. This is from a very, very low level. So it doesn't mean a lot. We're still way under the amount of inventory that we should have on the market, especially this time of year. This, you know, we're going into spring home selling season. This is the time when people do put their homes on the market, generally, historically speaking. So great news. It should be headlines saying great news. You know, there's more to choose from, but they don't like good news generally. It's the bad news that gets people's attention. So just again, be careful and know that this is, it's buyers versus sellers, right? There's buyer's market, there's seller's market. I mention this every time because it just depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to buy, more inventory is good. If you're trying to sell, well, you got more competition. So just depending on your market, it's either good or bad for you. When you're a flipper, you're kind of doing both, right? You're trying to buy and sell in a very short amount of time. So you're going to have to be especially good at beating the competition, you know, in times when there's more competition. So bottom line, we're not anywhere near the inventory levels that we should be at for a healthy market. So don't worry when you see these headlines. It just means that we're moving towards healthier.
And if you want to talk about tight inventory and how this isn't affecting our Seattle's market, this flip for Kent, I just put out 2.1 miles from the location of this house. There's zero homes for sale.
What?
Everything is sold.
And it's like suburban, right?
Suburban. This is a highly dense Like, these are 9,000 square foot suburban life.
And that is just not healthy. Again, like that, you guys need inventory. And considering that prices are up and mortgage rates are up, I mean, it's probably good that there's a limited amount because, you know, who can buy it at that? But the people who can are jumping in.
And even more exciting, Dave, they're selling for a lot of money, too, I'm looking at right now.
Don't tell me that yet. I don't want to know. We got to wait till this thing actually sells.
I just did a live spot check on the value.
All right. I like hearing that.
Henry, how are we doing on our bet here?
We are golden. Don't you worry about that.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody makes mistakes. I won't hold it against them.
Mistakes. Remember, where are we going to have those steaks?
Steaks are steaks. Oh, God.
Wonderful. Does Nobu have steak? That sounds delicious.
They do. I think it should be a Nobu dinner.
Ooh, okay. I like it. Either way, I get to go to Nobu. That sounds fun. We have one final headline, so stick with us because we're hitting that right after this quick break.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages. Until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right, get high quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting, from finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
Top real estate investors love to talk about how they save so much on taxes. But how are they able to build rental property empires while skirting Uncle Sam? 1031 exchanges. 1031 exchanges allow you to defer capital gains taxes while you sell an investment property, exchanging your old property for a bigger, better one and avoiding the tax man while you do it. And that's where First American Exchange Company comes in. They're the leaders in 1031 exchanges. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, First American Exchange can help you with simple rental property exchanges, complex commercial real estate investments, reverse exchanges, and more. Don't let your taxes eat into your profits. Visit First American Exchange Company at firstexchange.com. Or call them at 800-556-2520. That's firstexchange.com or 800-556-2520. Keep your money in your pocket and propel your portfolio further at firstexchange.com. First American Exchange Company does not provide tax or legal advice. Consult your financial, real estate, tax, or legal advisor about your circumstances. First American Exchange Company. Safe, smart, secure.
All right, well, let's move on to our last headline today, which is Real Estate 2024. Here's the income you need to afford a 500K home in every state. So 500K, that sounds like an expensive home, and it is, but it's only about 15% higher than the national average right now. The national median home price is about $415,000. So it is above average, but this is what a lot of people are trading on and aspire to buy right now. So I think it's a relative amount. So what this article does is look at, of course, the home price, which we're telling you is $500,000, rates, which is going to be very similar from state to state. But in each state, it might vary taxes. For example, like in Texas, property taxes are double the national average. Or insurance. We've all heard about California and Florida and how that impacts home prices. And so basically, this article looks at every state. And what they found was that no matter what state you're in, you need a salary of over $100,000 to afford this $500,000 home. Kathy, what do you think this means for the state of the housing market? Not for investors, we're talking about home buyers here, but what do you make for this and what it means for sort of the national home buying climate?
It means you better get married because you need two people. In a lot of areas, the median income is 50, you know, around 50, 60,000 for the first time home buyer age. And so if there's two of you, well, you can maybe make it happen. Might be harder for singles. You got to be making 100 grand, right, to be able to buy a house. But maybe you buy a cheaper one in that case. Maybe you don't need all three bedrooms. But yeah, bottom line is it's getting more expensive. It's getting more expensive and you got to make more money somehow to make it work.
I guess that's why I saw a recent headline about groups of friends joining together to buy houses. It does make a good headline. I doubt that's really like happening in any really significant amounts of numbers, but it just does show some of the trends that people are trying to do to get into the housing market. James, I'd ask you about this question, but are there even $500,000 homes in Seattle?
There definitely is. Like Pierce County, our surrounding counties, that's kind of the price point that plays well. You know, the thing that kind of blew me away when I was reading this article is I was talking to a buddy of mine, and this is probably last year, and he does really well in tech sales. And we were talking about like that mindset when you leave college, right? And if someone would have told me my senior year of college that I could sign a contract right now to make $100,000 for the rest of my life and just lock in on a job, I would have highly considered it. And I would have thought I was rich.
Totally.
And now $100,000 isn't the same thing, which is crazy. It's like this massive impact. And thank God that opportunity didn't come my way. But it does. I mean, that's a scary thing because a lot of people are not making that kind of money. And 500 grand is, you know, in a lot of markets, as this median home price national starts creeping up and up and up, that's kind of the average price. Whereas the average salary is like what Kathy said is around 60. And so this could really transform how people are looking at housing and how, you know, whether it's the co-living, it also could make these hedge funds look like geniuses, right? Because if people can't afford them, they have to rent. It is something we definitely want to be paying attention to as you're an investor because, you know, even if their margins are a little tight right now, it could really increase the rent demand for the population because a lot of people aren't going to be able to afford to buy, which is kind of sad. And I think it does need to be kind of solved. And I think a lot of cities are trying to do that by passing more density, like allowing these ADUs, provide more cheaper housing. But then the thing that we're seeing in Seattle is the ADUs aren't any cheaper. They're selling for record pricing and they are selling for high price per square foot. So this affordable housing issue that's going on, the solutions they're coming up with aren't really working that well. And it is something that you want to pay attention to as an investor. You know, like right now, I'd like to buy more single family housing because I just think people are going to have to rent, you know. And so going into those more affordable markets, especially like you can really target areas, right? Like if we go down to Pierce County, like Tacoma area, that's about 45 minutes out of Seattle. The median home price down there is going to be in that high fours. And if you can buy stuff in that 280, 250, which you can, and improve it and keep as a rental, there's not that many people that are going to be able to afford that down there. So they're going to have to be renters, and that's going to kind of naturally pull up the rent income. And so you can definitely put a strategy behind this. Affordability is a big deal. And as you're looking to expand your portfolio, you really want to be thinking about it. It's not just, hey, what can I buy this for? What can I rent it for? It's what is this going to look like in 5 years? And it could look a lot better your way.
And Henry, I mean, $500,000 for your market is sort of towards the high end of the range. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be a higher end home typically in my market.
So you're not probably seeing that much competition at that level. Like, where would you say the comp, you know, the real sweet spot where there's just like a ton of competition in your market?
Yeah, 250 to 350.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really interesting headline, and I'm glad I read the article, but I think that is really sort of what I think is most important here is like trying to figure out like what is the like range of affordability in your particular market and how competitive that's going to be and whether people can afford or if there's, let's just say, if there's inventory, enough inventory for prices that people in the local area can actually afford. Because I think, you know, in James's market, people would be clamoring to get a $500,000 home, whereas where Henry's market, it's not as relevant because what people can afford is more in that 250 to 300 range. And that's why there's so much competition there.
You know, what this article did for me was it really did kind of shine a light on what does affordability really mean? I mean, if you're looking through each one of these states, the average salary people have to make, I barely saw any that were under $110,000 a year. And I would bet that the average salary in most of those states isn't above that $100,000 a year mark. And now I understand that every one of these markets calls a $500,000 home, like a starter home or a beginner home. But when you think about it from that perspective, like what the average person needs to make to afford that kind of a down payment versus what the average salary is in that market, it kind of shows you, it kind of puts a bright light on what is affordability? What does that really mean to the everyday consumer?
Absolutely. Well, thank you all so much for going through these headlines with me today. I appreciate it and think that we had a really good discussion. If you all appreciated this discussion, don't forget to leave us a review either on Apple or Spotify. I'm Dave Meyer for James Daynard, Kathy Fecky, and Henry Washington. We'll see you for the next episode of On the Market. On the Market was created by me, Dave Meyer, and Kaylin Bennett. The show is produced by Kaylin Bennett with editing by Exodus Media. Copywriting is by Calico Content, and we want to extend a big thank you to everyone at Bigger Pockets for making this show possible. The housing market is changing, and finding your way right now can be a bit tricky. There are rate shifts, there are confusing headlines, but at the end of the day, your goal hasn't changed. You probably still want financial freedom as much as ever. Well, the good thing is that experienced investors know it's not about trying to time the market, it's about the amount of time you have in the market. And if you're ready to get into real estate investing game, you can still do that. Or you can take your game to the next level by finding an investor-friendly agent. With BiggerPockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in just a few minutes. You head over to biggerpockets.com/deals, enter in some details about what you want, where you want to buy, and boom, you instantly get matched with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today. The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only. Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own. Investments in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose. Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.